So my topic tonight is Catholicism and science. Now, when asked what I would like to speak on and asked what I am going to speak on, I instinctively want to say science and the church. But that can give an unintended implication that I'm coming from the perspective of science as the metric by which all things are measured, the church included. And that's certainly not my intention. In fact, the very opposite. The reason why I tend to say science first is because of just of my personal history. You know, I was born and baptized during the infamous council, and I came of age in a church that was in turmoil and confusion, and I developed a very negative opinion about faith and religion in general, and Catholicism in particular. And so I did not have the Catholic background that, say, the luminaries, scientific luminaries such as Galileo, who's often credited with beginning science as we know it, not for his views on heliocentrism, but for his work on fallen bodies, or even an Anglican like Newton, who is considered one of the all-time greats of science. Interesting enough, his main interest was theology, not science as we know it. That was kind of an aside. That was just an insignificant part of his work. His main work was, and unpublished, was in theology. Or even an Einstein, who said, God does not play dice with the universe. So this religious background of these scientific men recognized as scientific greats seemed foreign to me. And so the fact that I tend to say science first is just because of my personal history what appealed to me in science was this inculcation in my mind of a great love and reverence and fealty to the truth. And so from that, as I started to look at the church and started to delve deeper into science, I saw that science had limitations in that quest for love and fealty to the truth. And as I hit those limitations, I saw science was pointing to the church. So you have to forgive me if I seem to be coming from a perspective of a scientist that's measuring things against science. That's not my intention. My intention is to point out that science is pointing to the church, with the church being the source of science as we know it. Indeed, the mother of science as we know it. It's no accident that science developed in Christian Europe. And many philosophers of science have wondered, you know, why this distinction? Why did science, as we know it, develop in Christian Europe and not among the ancient Greeks, who were so advanced in sciences, or even the Arabs and Muslims, who had made some great advancements? But science never flourished and flowered as it did in Christian Europe. There's something unique there. And you know, as we see science and know it today, such as the university system, where science is still taught under that system. Of course, that's uniquely Catholic. That came to us from Catholic. And our definitions of the sciences, as we understand them, come from Thomas Aquinas, after Aristotle. So he defines science as the knowledge of things from their causes. And there are distinctions of different types of sciences. There's historical, there's social, there's ethics, there's law, the medical and biological sciences, natural sciences, and then, of course, there's theology, which Thomas points out is the ultimate science, because it is the study and knowledge of the ultimate cause. Now, my training is in the exact sciences, or what's known as the exact sciences. Thus called because they seek a very high degree of precision and exactness, and so mathematics is a very important part of it. And it's really this type of science that when someone says science, that's the science that they think of. They don't think of the science of history or social sciences or any of those, because that's the science that's had so much influence on our lives, and the scientific developments and the exact sciences such as physics and chemistry and biophysics, which I've studied. And it has such an impact on the technology that's so important in our lives today. And so that's what people think of most of when you say science. And so when I'm saying science, that's really more of what I mean, more of the exact sciences, the experimental sciences. Because that's where the perceived conflict between the church and science is mainly seen. That's where the conflict is mainly perceived. Now, the experimental sciences are considered the most reliable because of this exactness that they seek, this precision that they seek, and because of the great emphasis on methodology. And of course, an emphasis on methodology, well, that's certainly nothing new. It's hard to find more emphasis on methodology than the scholastics. Thomas literally wrote the book on it. So that can also be seen as coming from the church, this very important part of science as we know it, this emphasis on methods and precision. You know, one of the things that I found most interesting in my study of science, even though there's this great emphasis on methodology, there is no requirement of any institution that I know of for any scientific degree. There's no requirement for a course in the philosophy of science, which always struck me as kind of strange. That if sciences are working so hard for precision, it seems like you would really want to examine the philosophical basis with a great deal of scrutiny, and that you would want your students to be very well versed in the philosophical concepts and assumptions and precepts of science. And I don't know of any course or program which rewards doctorates, even doctorate levels that require a course in the philosophy of science. And I guess this is because scientists and professors of science seem to perceive science as something that is learned in the doing. And in fact, anytime you want to wax philosophical and talk about philosophy, they tend to roll their eyes and they don't really want any part of it. And I've even heard professors denigrate philosophy and as just a waste of time, and it's just a fantasy land. They're and consider themselves experimental scientists as the only sources of truth. That outside of experimental science, there is no truth. Now, that's not to say that there hasn't been some discussion and some efforts to elucidate the key components in the philosophy of science. Karl Popper is one of the most well-known in that respect, a philosopher of science. Another man, a Nobel laureate, Richard Feynman, is a very interesting character, has a very vivacious personality, and he's often waxed philosophical about science. And in fact, in an interview, he was asked, how does science work? What's the process? How do you do science? And his first response was, I'd agree to discuss that with some trepidation because I fear that I may be like the caterpillar who was asked, how is it that with all those legs, you have all those legs, hundreds of legs, how are you able to walk without getting all tripped up? And so he said, I'm afraid that if I try to understand how I'm doing it, I'll just trip myself up. Richard Feynman also had another interesting idea an example that pertains to the philosophy of science. He was talking about how even though things can look like they are scientific and have all the accoutrements and of science, that doesn't necessarily make them so. He gives the example of the cargo cults in the Pacific during World War II. And these natives of these islands where the U.S. had these bases, they developed these cults around these bases where the cargo would come in and these planes would come in and they'd bring all these great things, chewing gum and all these wonderful things. But then after the war, when the bases were closed down and all the troops left and planes weren't flying in anymore, these cargo cults developed where you'd have these natives, they would put lights out along the runway. A guy would get up in the tower with coconuts on his head and make these noises. And so they're doing all of the things that they saw were being done that then resulted in the planes landing, but the planes didn't land. And so he uses that as an example of how even though the entrapments can be there, it's still not necessarily science. And so you start to see that what, in trying to understand what is science, it becomes fairly ephemeral. It's kind of hard to pick down what is science. And of course, I'm sure that traditional Catholics devoted to the traditional sacraments and faith can also see another parallel with the cargo cult. This was one of the things about the new church that kind of turned me off. I saw they were doing all these things. I just never saw the planes land. All these things are supposed to bring these graces, bring these wonderful things, but where were the planes? Where were all the graces? I didn't see them land. And that's not to say that people didn't have graces, but the ones that I saw that seemed to have the most were those that were clinging as best they could to their faith in spite of all these changes. It seemed more that they had some cargo stowed away that they were getting to, rather than new graces coming in with all the new sacraments. Now, it's often said by the real extremist, ideological extremists and, who hold that science is the only, experimental science in particular, is the only means of gaining knowledge of truth. They often say that faith has no role in science. And perhaps many of you have heard that said often before. And perhaps in a limited sense, you could say that as a matter of course could be true. So if I'm doing my experiments, I'm a research scientist, so I'm doing my experiments, and it doesn't work out the way I expect, I shouldn't say, a miracle happened. It didn't happen the way I expected because it was a miracle. That should not be the first recourse. But that cannot be true in a general or in a completely dogmatic sense that faith has no role in science, because if you can act without faith, the only way anyone could act without faith would be to be all-knowing. You'd have to be all-knowing. If you're not all-knowing, then you have to have some faith that any action that you take is going to have some predictable outcome. So you have to have some faith to take any action. So even just having faith that you can get to the truth by careful experimentation. Even to engage in activity, you have to have faith that doing these careful experiments will get you closer to the truth. So you can't say just across the board completely there's no room for faith in science. There is a faith of science. Science does have a faith. So what are the metaphysics of science? What are the articles of faith that science holds? Well, the first and most important one that I would list is that truth is objective. That is, that truth exists outside, and reality exists outside of any one person, outside of my understanding. Doesn't matter how well I do or don't understand something, the truth of the world does not change. And if it ever does seem to change, truth hasn't changed. It's just our ability to understand it, whether we can only go move closer or further away from the truth, but the truth itself cannot change. And that is a fundamental tenet of faith of science. If truth is not objective, if truth does not exist outside and independent of us, then there's no reason to do science whatsoever. Another fundamental tenet is that science is universal. To use a Greek word, science is Catholic. That is, if I do an experiment and then I describe how I did the experiment in sufficient detail, then anyone of any time, if they repeat that experiment, they will get the same result. Doesn't matter if it's the very first man, if it's Adam, or the very last man. Doesn't matter race or creed. None of that matters. They should get the same results because truth is universal. Truth is Catholic. That's another fundamental tenet of the scientific faith. And there are other parts that or more precepts, such as science is conservative. Science is meant to be very conservative. If a new idea comes up, it should be treated with great skepticism. So novelty is not something that science is supposed to readily accept and go for. Science is supposed to be conservative because otherwise you're just going to be falling for the latest philosophical fashion of the day. So, and it's often said that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And so the more novel something is, the greater skepticism it should be treated with. That doesn't sound very inconsistent with Catholicism to me. Another concept is that regardless of how well through science we come to understand anything, it will always be complete. Incomplete. We can never have complete knowledge of anything. And so it's often said that no theory can be said to be true with absolute certainty. It doesn't matter how well a theory is supported, doesn't matter how long it's been around, you still cannot say that that theory is absolutely true from a scientific perspective. And that's because in order to know with absolute certainty that something's true, you'd have to be all-knowing again. So it's always incomplete. And also, it's another tenet is that no matter how well established a theory is, it always should be tested. It still should be treated with skepticism. You should always try to disprove it. Now, that's the general idea, but if you hear someone speaking, a scientist, when they're talking, they're asked about something. You may have seen programs where some scientist has discovered something, and the interviewer will say, "Oh, so that means this." Well, then the scientist will say, "Well, it indicates that." You know, they're always hedge because there's this concept in science that you need to be very careful. Don't assume that you know more than you know. You need to have a humility. And so humility is actually considered a great virtue, perhaps the greatest virtue for a scientist, is to be humble. And whenever people speak of some great scientist, you know, often hear them talk about their humility and their qualities of humility. And that's because the only way to truth is humility. And so there's a concept of the more humble you are, then the closer to you can approach to truth. That certainly doesn't sound like it contradicts Catholicism to me. It sounds like Catholicism supports that and really provides the whole basis for that concept. Now, there's an emphasis on doing experiments, and sometimes experiments can't really be done. You can gather evidence. And when the definitive experiment can't be done, then usually they'll appeal to what's known as the law of parsimony, or Occam's razor. And that law is that states that the simplest explanation is the best explanation. And that's a big part of heliocentrism versus geocentrism, that the planets and Earth revolve around the sun rather than everything revolving around the Earth. It's because when you do the mathematics for heliocentrism are simpler. And also, then Newton, with his law of gravitation, then provided further support for heliocentrism. But that's an example of where the law of parsimony comes into play and came into play in the history of science. Heliocentrism was the best explanation because it was the simplest explanation, mathematically speaking, anyway. So, as I said, you don't, as a scientist and a scientist in training, you can seek out a course on the philosophy of science. Your professors may kind of roll their eyes, but you can go to the philosophy department and seek out that a course in the philosophy of science. But you're supposed to learn science in the doing. Although often in freshman level courses in college, they will begin with an introduction to what's called the scientific method. Although I have a particular colleague of mine that says, "Oh, scientific method, yeah, they run on that, but you just do it and you don't really go by the scientific method." Well, what's usually described as the scientific method? And in its most basic description, the scientific method begins with observation of a phenomenon that you're interested in and a description of what you observe. And then from that observation, then you formulate a hypothesis. Trying to figure out how something works, so you say, "Well, maybe it works this way," and that's your hypothesis. And you need to have a hypothesis that's sufficient enough that then you can make a prediction. So, if this hypothesis is true, and I perform an experiment in this manner, this is the expected result. And then once the experiment's done, and of course you want to take particular care to have the proper controls, because there are many different variables that can change while you're doing your experiment, but you want to have the the best controls that you can, the best methodology that you can. And so then when you get that data, when you get the results of that experiment, then you interpret it and see whether it confirms your hypothesis, if you got the result that would be expected if that hypothesis is true, or whether it contradicts the hypothesis. And depending on the results, then you either say, okay, well, this has confirmed my hypothesis, or the hypothesis needs to be rejected, or I need to modify the hypothesis. And then you begin the whole process all over again. Well, that doesn't strike me as terribly unique. That seems to be generally how everyone's operated, you know, from Adam and until the last man. When we get something new, say we get a new car, and we're like, oh, okay, so where do I turn on the lights? Okay, maybe this button. So you test your hypothesis. And, oh, either it works or it doesn't. So there's the scientific method in its basic form doesn't really seem to suggest anything particularly unique. This is how we all have evaluated data and evaluated different phenomena and how we try to understand things. We all basically go through this process. In this sense, we're all scientists, really. So what's the peculiarity of science? If science is doing what we all do, and trying to understand something, what makes science unique? Well, one thing, there's that emphasis on careful methodology. Thank you, St. Thomas. And also a great striving for very precise measurements and a great striving to come to formulate very precise definitions. And then once you have a precise definition, you try to increase the precision of those definitions. And so a step backward would be to make the definition more ambiguous. That's going to move you away from the truth. And again, many of you may see another parallel with the church and what's gone on recently with the church. The church has set the example for precise definitions and ever improving clarity in definitions until this last century, where it rolled back. And so from a purely scientific viewpoint, it's moving away from the truth. And of course, that's always been the church's viewpoint, that definitions become more precise. They should never go backwards. So I mentioned the emphasis on methodology, which we have the scholastics to thank for that. But to me, what really stands out in the scientific approach to understanding, as opposed to what we generally do, is an emphasis on finding errors. And in fact, it's taught that the best way to test a hypothesis is try to disprove it. Not try to prove a hypothesis, because then you leave yourself open to missing things that would contradict it, because you want to prove it. That's part of our fallen nature, if you will, that we want to know the truth. And we're created, and it's just inherent in us that we want to know the truth and get closer to truth. But after the fall of Adam, we want to make the truth be what we want it to be. We want to be as gods. We want to be the definers of truth. We want to be Elohim, translated as a prince or a judge or a god. We want to be the definers of truth. That's our fallen nature. So we have this competing desires. And I used to preach this when I was an agnostic, if not an atheist, if there's any difference between the two. I used to preach that. I said, look, what we have this competing desire. We want to know the truth, but we also want to make the truth be what we want it to be. And the truth is going to lose out almost every time. Because if the truth isn't what we want, then we'll try to ignore it. If that doesn't work, we'll try humiliating it. If that doesn't work, we'll scourge it, we'll crucify the truth. And this was coming from someone who claimed to have no concept or belief in God or faith whatsoever. That I was stating this is just a fact of human nature. So, it kind of perked my eyes up when I saw that, wait a minute. I'm preaching Christ crucified. I'm preaching that our relationship is to the truth is that we crucify the truth. Now that didn't come from any religious trainer or anything. That came from doing science with the intention of increasing my love and fealty for the truth. And because that is something you're going to have to face, and that's something actually inherent in the scientific faith, in our ability to move closer to the truth. So, I would say the main article of faith in science, from where science really derives its power, is this faith that it is the will that is lacking. It's not the intellect. Because when you look at the way science actually works, how new discoveries come about, how they're evaluated, how the whole process, the whole scientific process, it is all designed to mortify the experimenter's bias. That's why you'll do experiments, they call them blind or double-blind experiments, where you don't know what the samples are, so that when you test them, you don't even unintentionally do things that are going to bias the results to give you the result you want. Because if you know that, oh, this is X and this is Y and I want X to be right, you may do something, even unintentionally. And there's an example, there's lots of examples of where these kinds of things happen. There was something called facilitated communication, where these people were working with these children with autism. And so somebody had the idea of, well, maybe the reason why they can't communicate is because there's just a hurdle they can't get over. So if we put a keyboard in front of them and just move their arm towards the keyboard, get them past that step, then they'll be able to press and communicate what they want to communicate. And so lots of people lost their children, lots of people went to prison, because all these stories came out from these facilitated communications that these children were being abused by their parents. So eventually someone actually looked at it with a better methodology, with a method where the experimenter could not see, so they would show like some shape or some symbol and then have it communicated what that is. And the facilitator could not see it, but the child with autism could, and the facilitator saw something different. Well, what was communicated was what the facilitator was seeing, not what the child with autism was seeing. So all this that was being written that came completely from the imagination and from the biases of the facilitator. So to me, that was a particularly powerful example, especially the way it ruined lives, of how if you're not careful, then your biases will rule over the truth. And so the methodology and the whole process of science is really focused on overcoming that bias. That's the real power of science, is trying to come up with ways where our biases, what we want to be the truth, won't win out over truth. So far as I can tell, everything that I've mentioned is completely consistent with Catholicism. In fact, the church is has dealt with all these things and expressed all these ideas with a much greater understanding and much more informatively than we've gotten from science itself. So where is this perceived conflict between the church and science? It's pretty hard to find some place where the church and science conflict. In fact, I don't know of anyone that's ever found an infallible pronouncement that conflicted with anything, any scientific knowledge. Perhaps that's why Galileo comes up over and over again. And I guess I have to mention Galileo because any talk on the Catholic Church and science, it's obligatory to at least say something about the Galileo affair, or as many historians are now beginning to call it, the Galileo legend, because in fact that's what it is. So Galileo is credited with starting science as we know it. When he studied the fallen bodies and developed his law of fallen bodies, he used a very precise, methodical method, and he was very careful in his experiments, and he kept it very simple with one variable, and so he really set the mark for all the science to follow. And when Newton said, "If I've seen farther than other men, it's because I stood on the shoulders of giants," he was referring to Galileo. And the church was, and especially the princes of the church, the cardinals, they were very, very supportive of Galileo. They were close friends of Galileo because he was doing some wonderful work. He was applying the scholastic methods, and he was applying all the teachings of the church to understanding the truth about natural phenomena. The church was his light in how he approached understanding natural phenomena. That's why he started science as how he was able to start science as we know it. So he had great support. Unfortunately, this seems to had made the temptation of pride far too great for Galileo to withstand. And when he looked with his telescope at Jupiter and saw the moons orbiting around Jupiter, he said, "Aha! And it's been said that all celestial bodies revolve around the Earth. Well, these are revolving around Jupiter, therefore not all celestial bodies revolve around the Earth." But then he went even further with a non sequitur. Because then he said, "So I think heliocentrism is true." Well, it doesn't follow. Just because the moons of Jupiter aren't revolving around the Earth, that doesn't mean that the Sun isn't revolving around the Earth. No proof whatsoever. He did not have any proof at all that the Earth was revolved around the Sun. And in fact, he's not credited in any way with contributing to the proof of heliocentrism. It's Johannes Kepler, and who used the very careful observations and recordings of planetary movements made by Tycho Brahe, and then did all the mathematics and showed that it was, the mathematics were more parsimonious, that they were simpler if the Sun was at the center. That's when heliocentrism was taken as proven. And in fact, I believe it was Cardinal Bellarmine that wrote in one of his letters to Galileo, he pleaded with him, "Please don't do this. If you can't try to force this proposition of heliocentrism without proof. If you get proof, fine, that's great, that's wonderful. But without proof, you're doing an injustice. You're doing an injustice to the truth. an injustice to science. So this has been completely misrepresented. And so, I mean, even when I was researching for this talk, I'd see articles that say, well, knowledge, our approach to knowledge has gone through different stages. There was the authoritative stage where the Pope and the Church said everything they made, and then there was the scientific stage where Galileo was persecuted because he relied on evidence and the Church relied on faith, and so he was persecuted for his evidence of heliocentrism. Well, my question is, what evidence? If you go by science, as I've just elucidated and as it's taught, which is, well, if you don't have evidence, don't claim to have knowledge. That with this science, with this extraordinary demand for evidence, you must have evidence. If you don't have evidence, then you cannot claim knowledge. Well, Galileo was very unscientific, anti-scientific, in pushing for heliocentrism. And the fact that it appears that he turned out to be right, that doesn't make him any less unscientific, because he was actually attacking the integrity of science by saying, look, I'm the great Galileo. Everybody lauds and praises me for my previous scientific work, and if I think this is true, it must be true. That's a very, very unscientific. In fact, Galileo acted in the way that the Church is accused of acting. And so if the Church is falsely accused and falsely condemned, and condemned for being falsely accused of acting that way, what about Galileo, who actually did act that way? Who actually did demand that his authority define truth? But yet Galileo is considered, some strange sense, even though he was attacking the integrity of science, he's presented as this martyr for science, when it's the exact opposite. Well, maybe I've belabored that point way too much, but the reason why that's so important, I think that's such an important example, is because it shows that even though scientists will say this is the way it's supposed to be, and the critics of the Church will say this is how it goes, well, when it turns out not to be the way that they present it, they're not really being scientific about it. They're not really approaching the Galileo affair scientifically. And what it shows is that their motives are not an appreciation and love for science, but really a hatred for the Church. They're just looking for any excuse. So this is, the Church is presented as being incompatible and opposed to science, but where are the examples? The best they can do is Galileo. And you don't have to be a scientist. All you have to do is be objective, and you can see that the Church was on the side of science in the Galileo affair. The Church was defending the integrity of science. You can't demand something to be true if you don't have evidence for it. And that's the best they can do. So science developed, it grew, it flowered under the protection of the Church. No one can provide any evidence that the Church has ever persecuted or set science back. In fact, if you look at the evidence, which those who propose that science, experimental science, is the only way that we can know, really have true knowledge, well, the evidence says the Church is the greatest thing that ever happened to science. It's the actual source of science. It's the mother of science. And science has done the best under the protection of the Church. So there's a demand for evidence, but not in this case of heliocentrism, because that's the only way that they can criticize the Church. And because the Church is being conservative, a supposed scientific virtue of being conservative. You make this extraordinary claim. Oh no, you know, actually it's the Earth's revolve around the sun. Well, you're supposed to be conservative and not jump on those conclusions. So, with this demand for evidence, you know, the experiment actually has already been done in terms of the question of whether the church is an adversary of science, whether the two conflict. So we've already had the experiment of science under the church, and we can only see it flourishing. So many great scientists. I mean, you could fill all these walls with these great scientific luminaries that were of deep Catholic faith. Science grew out of the church. So that part of the experiment's been done. We've had science under the protection of the church. Well, the other experiment has been done as well. So what about science outside of the church? Science in a cultural and political system that completely rejects the church, that completely rejects faith. What about science under atheistic communism, which is supposed to be science? Science is the end-all and be-all in all politics. It's almost a worship of science. So science is supposed to be held in the highest esteem in atheistic communism. Has science done very well under atheistic communism? And what's happened in such states, in such cultures, is scientists have been bitterly persecuted, much more than even the false claims of the church's persecution, because under those systems, science is in service of the state. Forget about truth. It's got to serve the state. That is the only real truth. So the supposedly scientific system of communism, that part of the experiment's been done, and the hypothesis failed. Science did not do better under communism. It actually fared far, far worse. And there are many, many stories of these persecuted scientists in these communist states that it has to serve. If their work didn't serve or contradicted what the state wanted, then look out. It's not going to be good. Well, what about the French Revolution? The experiment was carried out there. We're going to throw off the shackles of the church. Science is going to be free. With this revolution in France, we're going to have ushered in an age of science and of reason. Well, under that revolution, scientists weren't just persecuted, as the church has falsely claimed to have done. They were executed. The great Lavoisier and many other scientific luminaries, they weren't just persecuted, they were executed. So this revolution is supposed to usher in, throw off the church so that it can usher in an age of science and reason. It then executes the scientists. So the hypothesis is failed there. I mean, the French didn't get an age of science and reason. Quite the opposite. They got the Great Terror. And the Great Terror only ended when it was supplanted by an even greater terror. Until the French Revolution devoured its own self. So, throwing off the church didn't protect science. In fact, it resulted in the destruction of some of the greatest scientific luminaries ever known. So, if someone wants to truly look at it from the scientific perspective that I described, and that you will find if you look up the philosophy of science and you look up the methods of science, where you do the hypothesis, see the results of the hypothesis, if it doesn't fit your hypothesis, then you have to dump that hypothesis. Well, the hypothesis that the church is an impediment to science has failed with every experiment. I've just mentioned a few of them here. So if the critics of the church want to truly be scientific, they would say, oh, wait a minute, we need the church. We need the protection of the church. Because otherwise, science falls prey to ideology. And even though the claim against the church is that the church will unduly influence science by ideology, we've seen the opposite. We've seen science has had the most freedom under the church, not under supposedly scientific systems. And being the mother of science, the source of science, then it's understandable. Because the goals of science, if the goal of science is love of truth, fealty to the truth, well, that's the exact same goal as the church. The church can only be supportive of that, and the church has always been supportive of that. And the church, as I've tried to elucidate, has always protected that. So that's not what they're really after. They're not really after true intellectual freedom, because that's been enjoyed under the church more than under any other system. Really what they're after is license. License to error. License to try to make science bend to what they want it to be. And that's, I think that's part of the problem with how the education in science has gone, especially since the church has been kicked out of the picture. Because students are not really learning about the philosophy of science, they're not learning about the metaphysics, they're not learning about the assumptions. For example, I was speaking with some medical students, and I was talking about truth. And one of the students said, yeah, but there's no truth. You can't know truth. You know, first you think it's this thing, then you think it's that. There's no truth. You can't know truth. Well, of course, my question was, well, then why are you studying medicine? If you can't learn, if you can't be taught the truth, if it's a, then there's no reason for you to study medicine. But that's, for me, is an example of how trying to throw the church off and trying to remove the church's protection from science leads to just confusion. Because if only what can be known by experimental science, if that's the only truth that you will take as valid, then you have some real problems. Because in anything that you do, there's ethical considerations. And if you say, well, whatever ethics you come up with, you can't know the truth. You can't know whether it's really right or wrong to do this. You can't know whether it's right or wrong to abort a child. You can't know whether it's right or wrong to euthanize. Well, then what are you going to get? You're going to get these ethical situation ethics, and you're going to get utilitarianism and all these things. And so what you're going to get is not trying to understand ethics from a love of truth, but trying to understand ethics in a way that will allow you to get what you want. And that's exactly what we see. Now, even though a course in the philosophy of science isn't required for scientists, a course in ethics is. But if you're coming from the viewpoint that, well, it's all arbitrary and subjective, well, then what kind of education in ethics do you get? And so I found it very interesting to see the students' responses to these ethics courses. Because we'd go in and we'd talk about ethics, and well, how do you feel about this? Or how do you feel? Well, I don't think that's right. Well, I do think that's right. And, oh, yeah, okay, well, yeah, you have a valid opinion. You're talking, yeah. Well, nothing ever came of it. You know, all you got was this wishy-washy, everybody has their approach to it, you know. And so the bottom line is, and you don't need an ethics course for this, the bottom line is what's right and what's wrong? Well, if you have a question, you send it to the ethics committee of the hospital or university, and they'll tell you, they'll give you the answer. And so if they say it's okay, well, it's okay. If they say it's not, well, it's not okay. Well, that leads to really great problems for science, because there are ethical consequences. Perhaps there are better examples, but I'm reminded of the man known as the father of the A-bomb, Robert Oppenheimer. When the bomb worked and it exploded, apparently he said with great remorse, "I have become Shiva, the destroyer of worlds." So, regardless of whether it was ethically correct to build the bomb, to unleash that kind of terror on the world, and it could be argued back and forth whether it's ethically justifiable, still you have to, you're going to have to wonder about whether it's really true or not. And if you have no stable basis for coming to an understanding of ethics and of right and wrong, well, then all you've done is give license to error. And so then science is just then rendered in the service of error. And, you know, there's been lots of, you know, as the church just has less and less influence, even now there's starting to become more and more concerns about what they call conflicts of interest. You know, like with pharmaceuticals, you know, all the science being done by pharmaceutical companies, and, well, they have a financial stake, so there's concerns about that problem. You know, is their research going to be biased because they have such a huge financial stake? And as a colleague of mine likes to point out, well, it's not just in research being done in the private sector, also in the universities. There's that same problem of conflict of interest, because once something becomes established as becomes what the government wants you to have. Well, I'll use the example of global climate change. You know, we're being told that the humans are causing global climate change, catastrophic global climate change. Well, science is supposed to always look for criticisms, always look to disprove that hypothesis. But if you see, read any interviews or see any interviews with climatologists, like Professor Lindzen at MIT, they'll tell you that if you come out with anything that does not support the idea of humans are causing global catastrophic change, you don't get money. You don't get to do research. So, without the church to really look over and protect the ethics, then, you know, science just becomes a tool of oppression. And so, as Oppenheimer's statements allude to, are scientists going to become, is it going to be said that, you know, all generations will call me accursed? As opposed to what is the real, true, should be the real true goal of scientists, which is to emulate our Blessed Mother in her love and fealty for the truth, an unparalleled and a love of fealty for the truth so great that truth itself became incarnate through her. That should be the real patron saint of science, is the Blessed Virgin, because through our love of truth and doing science, then in some small way, some reflection of our Blessed Mother, scientists could also be called blessed, because can make discoveries that will ease suffering, that will provide for corporal works of mercy. But without the voice of the church, I'm concerned of how much hope there is for that. As a matter of fact, apparently, Benedict is going to have a new encyclical in which he's going to go into the responsibilities that we have, the responsibility that we have to the environment. So if true, is that going to support this cry that, we're all destroying the world, therefore global government needs to have control, you have to limit your children? And this is already being said. You got to have the one-child policy of China. This needs to be instituted everywhere, because otherwise we're going to destroy the planet. And you have to pay taxes to the global government for your gasoline, because otherwise we're going to destroy the planet. Now, so you can see how easily science is now being bent and being abused to support something that's entirely unscientific. You know, this idea of catastrophic global warming being caused by humans. In which case, then we are heading to all generations calling science a curse, rather than what we should aspire to, that in some small way all generations will call us blessed. Thank you for your attention. Take any questions.